This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And filling in for Josh Larson this week, I'm Tasha Robinson.
Oh, Uncle, we're famous!
Hick the Faulkner, 65.
And Richard Baker, 13, had been missing now for 6 weeks. Faulkner is Caucasian. Well, they got that wrong because you're obviously white.
Julian Dennison in that clip from Hunt for the Wilder People, a coming-of-age story set in the New Zealand wild that has won over most of the people who've seen it, including my co-host this week. We've got a review of Hunt, plus the top five directors we'd bankroll.
Yeah, I don't think Taika Waititi is going to have to worry about money anytime soon. I think he's working with a slightly larger budget now.
Yeah, on the next Thor movie, part of the so-called Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think he's all set. That and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on. It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Tasha Robinson, you, of course, are a familiar voice to many listeners. You've been on the show several times over the years, but somehow you and I haven't done a show together one-on-one since, I think, the fall of 2011. Michael Phillips and Josh Larson, they can't hoard you any longer. Thank you for coming on.
Well, I've been a little busy with a little podcast we like to call The Next Picture Show, which you might be familiar with since it's a Film Spotting family podcast.
Indeed. It is part of the Film Spotting family. Proud to have it as part of that family. And you guys have been churning out great content. We'll talk probably a little bit about that more later. And of course, even if listeners aren't familiar with you from the show and your appearances here or The Next Picture Show, it's possible they've been reading you over at The Verge. How long have you been writing for The Verge now?
I started writing for The Verge almost immediately after the dissolve shut down in July of last year, but I've been a full-time staffer there since February.
All right, so TheVerge.com, where people can find your work as the film critic there. A recent poll question here on Film Spotting had us asking which director won the 2000s. The answer, according to Film Spotting listeners, was, maybe not much of a surprise, Christopher Nolan. That got us talking about who might win the 2010s, which got our co-producer, Sam Van Hallgren, and I thinking about our directors of the future top fives. This is something we've done a couple times over the years. And after several dozen back and forths on Slack with Sam later, we landed on this week's topic, the one we're going to get to a little bit later in the show, directors we'd bankroll. We'll explain what we mean exactly by that when we get to it. For our podcast listeners, you'll also get a few quick thoughts on a couple other releases in theaters now.
But before that, Taika Waititi leaves behind bloody frocks and swear wolves to go on a hunt for the Wilder people.
Ricky Baker.
He is a baddie, a youth court regular.
We're hoping that this change of scene will help straighten him out.
You hungry? That's a silly question, isn't it? Look at you.
Ricky Baker, now you are 13 years old. You are a teenager and you're as good as gold.
Ricky, this is Heck. You can call him uncle if you like.
No, I can't.
Bella told me to tell you that you should give me something to do. Is there anything you want me to do?
Yeah. Leave me alone.
Cool. You ever been up in that jungle before?
There's about a million hectares of it, buddy. It's easy to get lost.
You lost? I'm amazed how lost you got.
You little bastard!
We got no choice but to camp out here for a few weeks.
Where are you, Ricky Baker?
More on this massive national manhunt.
On my Letterboxd list ranking the Marvel Cinematic Universe, 2011's Thor eclipses just one movie, the second Iron Man. Two movies, if you count Thor: The Dark World, which I actually never even bothered to see. My point is, despite the fact that we're barely into the show and I've already said the word Thor, I think, four times, I don't actually care much at all that another Thor movie is currently filming. Furthermore, it risks doing a disservice to Hunt for the Wilder People and writer-director Taika Waititi to frame this review around speculation of what his Thor movie might be like. So I'll just beg everyone's indulgence here, at least to get our conversation going, because he's just such a surprising choice to helm a Thor movie, and I'm just basing that on his previous film, the marvelously cheeky mockumentary about vampire housemates living in Wellington, New Zealand, What We Do in the Shadows, a finalist last year for the Film Spotting Golden Brick, our award for our favorite underseen movie. It went on to win our listener's choice poll. Tasha, I believe you're more familiar with his work, which includes 2007's Eagle vs. Shark, 2010's Boy, HBO's Flight of the Conchords, and now Hunt, a movie about an in-and-out-of-foster-care 12-year-old named Ricky Baker, played by Julian Dennison, who only has in common with Thor a predilection for garish outfits. He also seems to regard himself as a movie character, though more of a Scarface than superhero wannabe, which means he doesn't exactly fit in at first after being sent to live out in the country with new foster parents, Bella and Hector. Hector is played by Sam Neill. Tasha, does Hunt's pleasures and Waititi's quirky comedic sensibility make you any more excited for Thor Ragnarok? Or do you wish, either for the sake of the Marvel Cinematic Universe or merely the Waititi cinematic body of work, that he just ply his trade out in the indie wilderness?
Well, you know, we've gotten a series of indie wilderness films from him, and they've all been delightful. But I'm really curious how he's going to manage a Thor movie. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious how he's going to manage a special effects spectacular. That's often probably the least interesting question about these like smaller directors that are brought in for MCU movies. The Marvel Cinematic Universe is such a machine at this point. I'm really curious how he's going to bring his personality into it. All of the interviews he's doing right now say that he's been given carte blanche. He's been given his freedom. He's doing what he wants to with the movie. Now, I mean, that's what he's going to say as a director who wants to keep his job. But if it's true, and we can only hope it is, what is a Thor with this kind of sense of humor going to be like? Mm-hmm. I think it's probably going to be delightful and maybe different. I mean, people said the same thing about James Gunn on Guardians of the Galaxy.
Sure.
How is his sensibility going to work? It's not. And then, you know, we came up with something that was very recognizably an MCU movie but had a very distinctive flavor mm-hmm. and voice. We're hoping for something like that. The Thor movies for me have been some of the weakest of the MCU series. And the best part of them, at least for me, was the sense of humor that emerged in like little spurts in the first film. I'm hoping for more of that. You know, Thor is most interesting, I think, as a character who's kind of out of place, out of time, and has a very particular straight-faced sense of humor where he doesn't realize the absurdity that he creates by being in whatever world he's in. And I think that's something Waititi does really well.
Yeah, so let's focus on that now, shifting from Thor a little bit. What specifically delights you about Waititi's sense of humor, and what delighted you about Hunt for the Wilder People?
I think Waititi has a very specific sense of humor that I don't know if this is primarily – he partially credits it to his Maori background. I interviewed him for The Verge, and one of the things we talked about was a scene in Wilder People where he actually appears in a small cameo as a preacher or pastor mm-hmm. overseeing a funeral, and he gives this speech that's just ridiculously specific and laughable. And I asked him about that scene, and he said – Maori funerals are about laughter as well as about grief. They go on for days, and they're not at all like Western funerals. So I kind of feel like he has this sensibility that's just very different mm-hmm. from a lot of like American humor that we're used to.
Yeah.
And the more I see his work, the more I think it's really specifically characterized by this kind of bravado, this braggadocio that is constantly undermined by failure and weakness. You know, the characters in Eagle versus Shark are kind of these pathetic people who don't realize like how small and sad their lives are and think of themselves in these grand egotistical terms. You see the same thing in What We Do in the Shadows. Mm-hmm. It's hilarious in both cases. And then in Hunt for the Wilder People, he blows it up and then embodies it in this 12-year-old turning 13-year-old boy who thinks of himself as a gangster.
Yeah.
It's so egoless. It's such a fun sense of humor that the American sense of braggadocio and self-importance that we get in especially a lot of these superhero movies, it's kind of about like the fantasy of being impregnable, the fantasy mm-hmm. of being, you know, strong and being able to stand up to any kind of a fear or bad situation. His characters have that fearlessness, even though it's in no way justified, like either by who they are or by the situations they find themselves in.
Right.
And it becomes so absurd and so much fun.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And again, I'm fairly new to his work, but can say I'm safely a big fan after these last two movies. And you're dead on in how you characterize the Dennison character and what he's doing with the ego there and how he's subverting it. But you even see it a little bit in the Sam Neill character, where he's someone who doesn't have a lot to say. He certainly isn't someone who brags about who he is, but he carries himself in such a way. And Waititi sets it up to knock it down, where we assume he's, and one character even says, who's Crocodile Dundee, right? Mm-hmm. Where we think he's this man of the bush who is probably not capable of a coherent thought, and he's kind of a larger-than-life figure, but then that's cut down too, and we see him as just as human and just as vulnerable and needy as we see Ricky. So I think that really is one of the strengths of this movie. And overall, I was thinking about just how skillfully Waititi weaves the pathos and the sentimentality, never veering off into pure sentimentality, and the humor, weaving that all together. There are elements, of course, of really broad comedy here. The child welfare worker, Paula, is probably the most absurd character. I think she actually just gets even more absurd as the movie goes on. But that ability of Waititi's to weave all those elements made me think actually of Chaplin, right? That's mm-hmm. what everybody says about the best Chaplin films. And then, of course, it hit me that in a lot of ways, whether it was a direct influence or not, this film is actually a lot like the last Chaplin film I saw with my kids, which is The Kid. The movie with Jackie Coogan, where the tramp character encounters this little baby and gets stuck with him, an abandoned baby. And then we see them kind of 5 years later, and then the state comes to take him away, and they've developed this bond. So there's a similarity there in terms of them kind of being outlaws and them striking up this bond and being a father and son figure, even though they aren't really one. So again, don't know if it was a direct influence, but certainly a great double pairing with this movie. But the humor here is what really works. Just like with What We Do in the Shadows, that was a movie, I said during our review, it got funnier the more time I stayed away from it, because it's funny as you're watching it and you're laughing along with it. But then the more you think about the scenes that made you laugh, the funnier it becomes. And that's really the case here as I reflect on certain lines and certain scenes. I just think Dennison has so much natural charm. He's really able to express a lot with very little, with doing very little. He doesn't overplay that thug wannabe personality. He also doesn't overplay the vulnerability. And I think about just the deadpan nature, and I know that word gets thrown out a lot with Waititi and his sense of humor, but the way he and Waititi approach the opening scene where the child welfare people and a police officer are dropping him off out at Bella and Hector's farm. And it's this rundown home in the middle of nowhere. He's the city kid. And we watch as this whole dialogue happens between the welfare worker and the new foster parents. And he's just walking around surveying the place. And what does he do? Just casually gets back in the car and closes the door. He's ready to go. And I thought that was one of the funniest scenes in the movie, actually. And again, just the way it's just watching him in action, and we know everything we need to know just based on the way he plays the scene and the way Waititi captures him just subtly getting back in the car.
And you get such an image out of him, out of that first reaction to the place. I mean, he comes across as this sullen, shut-down teenager. And you can see in that moment the whole film unfolding before you. You know, he's going to have to slowly be drawn out of his shell.
Yeah.
The Paula talks about him as a kind of a mini-gangster, like a bad egg.
A bad egg, yeah.
Although the crimes she lists out for him, you know, kicking stuff, throwing stuff.
Spitting.
Are pretty low level. But in that moment, you see what the film is going to look like. And then pretty much in the next scene, Waititi completely upends that and Ricky starts behaving in a pretty surprising way. He's not the character that you assume he is. He's not the character that the cliche looks like.
Right.
And that was one of the most delightful things of the film for me, is it's so unexpected at every beat. There are so many films about, you know, shut down old curmudgeons and young orphan kids and how the two of them inform each other's lives. This movie is kind of Pixar's Up in a way, without the balloons and the talking dogs and with the New Zealand wilderness instead. But Waititi has a way of making it all fresh by making the character interactions just so surprising and making that kind of deadpan, straight-faced humor so so shocking without overselling it. There's no point in this movie where the characters feel like they're waiting for a laugh or setting up a laugh. They talk like people. They act like people.
We didn't even have a map. Where's our map?
Don't need one. I know where I am.
Probably couldn't even read it anyway.
Why would I need to read a map? I already told you I know where I am. Reading's stupid anyway.
Only people who can't read say things like that.
No.
You can't read?
What should
you're like one of those people who like race by like wolves or something, eh?
Ooga booga, me heck, me no me. What's this? This is words. Me stupid.
You little bastard!
You said it reminds you of Chaplin. It actually reminded me a little of British comedy, like the straight-faced absurdism of a lot of British comedy.
Yeah.
And I go to things like Monty Python's Flying Circus, which is, if you look at it, it's a very elevated comedy. You know, the members of Monty Python came from Cambridge and Oxford, and they do a lot of like classical references. This is like the public school version of Monty Python's Flying Circus. It's that kind of non sequitur absurdity and big, broad characters and just hilariously laughable lines without all of the references, which changes it a lot, but it's laugh out loud in the same way.
Yeah, even the scene you mentioned with Waititi as the preacher at the funeral, where he's just droning on and on about what's behind one door and what's behind the other door and the interjections from the crowd, that feels like something straight out of a Monty Python skit. I think you're exactly right. It also strikes me, and maybe this isn't the right word for it, but one of the things I really appreciated about the film was how it seems to be a meta film, not in the way we usually think about meta films, where it's trying to draw attention to itself as a movie or it's trying to make the audience constantly aware that they're watching a movie. But Ricky, primarily, but other characters too, they define themselves so much via popular culture. And we've alluded to that a little bit already. I just think here, the way Waititi does it, he did it in Shadows as well. It's not just something funny to riff on or poke fun at these characters for, but it ends up being a really astute observation about the way we live today, especially kids. The way we see Ricky name his dog Tupac and says he's like my best friend, talking about Tupac, not the dog, the actual
the
Tupac.
Rapper. Yeah, and, he shows up in the first scene in an All Eyes on Me jacket. Like that, it's and this series of really garish hoodies. Like the first hoodie has like tiny, I think, dollar bills and gemstones on it. Just, you know, to indicate
like
how bling he is.
Right. He's trying to project himself a certain way. He dresses and he talks a certain way to live up to that image. And even that child welfare agent at the end of the movie, there's a hilarious bit where her partner, the police officer, says to her, "Knock it off, New Zealand cops don't talk like that." For her, she's pretty much watched too many episodes of Law and Order, probably, on American TV, and she only knows how to act like a cop. Her only way to think of being a cop is to portray one that she's seen on TV. And that's, of course, also how she wants to see herself, just like he wants to see himself as a gangster. And she can get stuck in her delusional version of herself, too. She has this great line where she keeps going back to her motto, which is "No child left behind." But that ends up proving to not necessarily mean I'm going to make sure this kid doesn't slip through the cracks and he's going to get treated right. It's, damn it, they're not going to escape me is what it turns into. And there is, in one more meta way, there is a great great bit. My favorite line in the movie, probably because I'm a movie geek, is a scene I don't want to spoil for people.
It's in the trailers.
Okay, I'm still not going to spoil it. If people are out there who don't watch trailers, like I try to avoid them, but she has an exchange. She gets into an argument, basically, with Ricky about which character from a certain very famous sci-fi movie from the 80s they really are. So there are those touches, but the way that he draws on popular culture, again, not just to make fun of these characters or get some laughs out of it, but it really is how they define themselves, this certain image. And the movie spends a lot of time as well on language, how often people talk about what's the right word for this? I'm not quite sure how to say it, or they criticize someone else's use of a certain word. It just seems to fit into this larger scheme of these people trying to figure out how to talk, how to act, how to be whoever they want to be in this world.
And part of that self-definition is they have these self-images where they're trying to blow themselves up into something larger than they are. But that exchange that you don't want to spoil, one of the reasons it's so hilarious is because Paula, who is an adult woman who is in charge of child welfare, is having a very petty exchange with, at this point, a 13-year-old, and they're on the exact same level as each other. They're fencing about which of them is more like the thing that they want to be in the exact same way like two 13-year-olds would fight over which gets to be the cowboy and which gets to be the Indian in a game, like where one of them is more popular right now because of some TV show. There's so much tiny little pettiness that goes on here, and it's disguised as bravado in ways that just that make it so funny and so familiar in a way. You know, you know what it's like to want to be something bigger or more important than you are. It's part of what makes movies so much fun for us is living out all of these fantasies. So here you have people on the screen living out fantasies of living out fantasies. So I see what you mean by saying it's a meta movie. It's a little bit of a movie about how pop culture affects us.
Yeah, it really is. And I think there is a nice touch where Waititi really plays this out at the end of the film, where we'll just say it gets into more traditional kind of action movie territory. But I really think it works because it ends up playing out in a sort of be careful what you wish for scenario where Ricky sees himself as this outlaw gangster, right? And so Waititi, as almost a gift to the character, gives him his dream scenario. There's even a moment where a police car flips. And it's so, in a way, awkwardly staged that it draws just enough attention to itself to make you realize as a viewer that he is trying to make us aware of the fact that he did that just because it's something cool that happens in action movie finales like this. You know,
it's such a Blues Brothers moment.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And I think it is this gift in a way to that character who wants this to play out as this grand spectacle. He's going to get the opportunity to live that way. And we get to live it as well by watching him have so much fun in that moment.
And to some degree, what plays out from there comes from the fact that he looks around him and he sees himself as inside a movie, as inside a TV show, and he keeps pushing because of where his expectations are.
Right.
And the fact that not everybody in that sequence, in that world, in that scenario shares the same point of view and the same expectations also becomes very, very funny. One of the things I love about it, though, is that it's not commented on. It's meta in a way that we can recognize.
Right.
But there is no point. I mean, there is the cop saying cops in New Zealand don't talk like that.
Yeah.
But the characters in that scene, like there isn't a confrontation where somebody sits down with Ricky and says, you know, you have to understand that you're not a rapper.
No.
You're not in a movie. Mm-hmm. Like all of these things that in a much more blatant movie we would need to spell out thematically. Mm-hmm. We don't have to have that here. It would interrupt the fun. It would interrupt the parts of the movie we're enjoying to try to make it blatantly about something instead of subtly in an enjoyable way. Mm-hmm.
And I think connecting with that a little bit, I did read Manola Dargis's review in the New York Times. She was pretty high on this movie as well. And she ends by saying he's still finding his way, talking about Waititi, but he's already a director who, as he does in a shot of a friendly, undefeated child pausing to wave at a pursuer, this happens in that finale, can distill a worldview into a single perfect cinematic moment. And it did remind me of the experience I had watching that scene play out where, I don't know about you, but I just assumed I was going to get him flipping or the bird or something. Mm-hmm. That's something that probably would have made me laugh. Honestly, it would have been a very easy laugh. I think it would have got the audience to laugh where you think as he's going by in slow motion and the pursuer's there, the symbol of authority, he's going to do something to defy them. And instead, he's a 13-year-old boy who who is enjoying this. And so he just waves at her. And mm-hmm. That might be, Manolo Dargis is probably correct, that might be a perfect distillation of what makes Waititi's sensibility so much fun to watch.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the thing that everybody most remembers about What We Do in the Shadows isn't the really garishly bloody mayhem and murder. It's the moment where the pack of werewolves sheepishly, somebody utters a small curse word and their leader says,
"Hey, we're not werewolves. Yeah.
Waititi's films are nice. Like, they're nice in a way that is really shocking sometimes.
Right.
And this is a movie. I, without reservations, sent my mother and my mother-in-law to go mm-hmm. watch this movie, knowing that they wouldn't find anything objectionable in it. And yet, it isn't a soft movie. It isn't a bland movie. It isn't the kind of movie. It's the kind of movie that you could watch with your grandma mm-hmm. and still have fun, that isn't like a kind of ironic undercutting what's going on fun.
No.
It's genuinely nice. Like, these people are genuinely nice.
Right. And I'm just laughing still because not only does that line crack me up, the werewolves line, but it made me think of the other really nice, funny line from that movie where he says, "Now leave me to do my dark bidding," and then turns and is on eBay, of course. So I think we've talked about what makes Waititi unique as a director and why we are hopeful for what a Thor movie might be directed by him. He did remind me a little bit here, and not in any kind of thievery way, reminded me a little bit of what I like so much about Edgar Wright visually as a filmmaker, in terms of the way he uses the camera and he uses editing to heighten the comedy. There are a lot of cases here where we get zooms, where we get quick pans, we get quick cuts on action and sound. And I do love the way he utilizes these 360-degree shots in this film. There's three or four of them that end up being essentially what you would get in another film. They would be a montage set to music. They'd be 4 or 5 minutes long where we would elide space and time. But he literally elides space and time just by having the camera turn. And it's obviously a sort of special effect, but we see them in one space, and then as the camera turns, they've moved a little bit more, or they're at a different point in their journey. I just thought it was a really effective, kind of clever use of that.
I've got news for you. That was done in camera.
Was it really?
It was an entirely in-camera effect. The characters are literally...
That makes me love it even more.
I know. Well, seeing it a second time and watching for it, I was even more amazed.
I didn't think there's any way you could do that.
The actors are literally like ducking down under the
and
camera.
And then moving over.
Shedding their jackets and moving into different parts of the frame. That entire like 360 spin is done in camera.
So how much in-camera effects work will we get in Thor?
I think it's going to be 100%. I think it's going to be really difficult teaching Chris Hemsworth to fly, but I think Waititi is going to
insist on
it.
He could pull it off. Yeah.
I mean, if anybody could.
Well, Hunt for the Wilder People is currently playing in limited release. We hope you go see it. We hope you take your grandma. If you've already taken your grandma.
And your kids. I mean,
yeah.
I would take a 13-year-old boy to watch
this movie. I took my daughter. I took Sophie.
And did she love it?
My 12-year-old daughter. And she did really like it, actually. She was pretty much right in line with me. And yeah, she did. So I'm glad I took her. You're right. Absolutely bring your kids as well if you have them. And if you do see it, let us know what you thought, whether you agree or disagree with our takes. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. So for those with a dog in the fight, and there were a couple, the South Park versus Team America death match we posed a couple weeks back was surprisingly competitive. We'll get to those results and a new poll that looks ahead to the fall movie season. Stay with us.
Brother, go get that money.
Good morning, folks. Open the drawers.
You got a gun on you, old man?
You damn right I got a gun on me. Y'all gonna steal my gun too?
We ain't stealing from you, we're stealing from the bank.
Chris Pine and Ben Foster in a bit of the trailer for the new film Hell or High Water. This is a movie we just came from, Tasha, the latest film from David McKenzie, who made 2014's Startup a very good film, was a Golden Brick nominee that year here on the show. And what can we say? Pine and Foster, they play brothers. They rob banks like you do in West Texas, I guess, right?
Well, I mean, I don't personally rob banks in West Texas. And if I did, I would not admit it while being recorded.
Valid.
It's worth mentioning that Jeff Bridges plays a Texas Ranger who's on their trail.
Yes.
He is the prototypical lawman just a week away from forced retirement.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want to go. He would rather be on the trail of these outlaws. And so he has a personal stake in the hunt because he seems to think of it as a way that he can continue to draw out his employment and still have something to do.
Exactly. So we'll talk a little bit later in this segment about this movie and whether or not it gets into any other cliches, like the cliche of the lawman who's on the verge of retirement. On next week's show, Josh is going to be back. We'll probably spend a few minutes on the movie as well. He's planning to see it. We'll get into a little more detail then, and we're going to share our most anticipated fall movies or maybe our most anticipated questions of the fall movie season. That's a little bit of a different approach we've been taking to the usual fall movie preview, and we will also get to the sixth film in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon. So you can look forward to that. You can also look forward, if you are here in the Chicago area, to potentially seeing some free movies and seeing them before they come out. Some free movie passes to give away here, Tasha. And we have a ton of them. So I'm going to kind of just list the movies here and the dates. You can get all the details and enter at filmspotting.net. We've got Ben-Hur, which is somehow being directed by the guy who made Night Watch and Wanted, Timur Bekmambetov. That opens on Friday the 19th, and the screening is on Tuesday the 16th. The Hollers, the new film directed by John Krasinski and also co-starring John Krasinski along with Margot Martindale, Richard Jenkins, and Anna Kendrick. That comes out on August 2nd, and there's going to be a screening of that on August 19th, and I believe Krasinski is going to be in attendance at that screening on August 19th to do a Q&A afterward. And then there's a couple movies that are opening here in Chicago on the 26th, the latest from Werner Herzog, Lo and Behold, and A Tale of Love and Darkness. This is the directing debut of one Natalie Portman. So again, all the details, if you are interested in seeing any of those films, are available at filmspotting.net. Just look in the top story section. That's where you can enter. I thought I would throw this in, just a little bit of a note. A few weeks back, Josh and I spent a few minutes, Tasha, on the latest Star Trek movie. And one of the questions Josh threw at me was whether or not my projection of the movie was dark or not, because he had a really bad experience. Now, he did see it in 3D, and I mercifully avoided seeing it in 3D. But he said the projection was just very dark. He could barely make out what was happening most of the time on screen, and that hampered his experience, as you imagine it would. And I said it didn't really affect me at all. I did notice that in the 2D version of the film. But over on Letterboxd, in the comments to my review of Star Trek Beyond, we had a little dialogue going with some listeners. And Aaron Prescott mentioned that his screening was extremely dark, too. He said, I saw it in 2D, but noticed it was projected through a 3D lens, just no filter. You've got to turn up the lamps when you are splitting your image into two images. And another listener, Matthew Schlobaum, said, how could you tell it was projected through a 3D lens? Maybe that was my showing's issue too. And Aaron replied, look back in the projection window. If you see two image planes on the glass, then it still has a 3D lens on. A lot of houses keep the 3D lens on and will simply flip the 3D filter between a 2D and a 3D show. But splitting the image means less light is making it to the screen. So I don't know. I just thought I would have a little The More You Know segment here on Film Spotting this week, because I thought it was interesting. And I don't know if you had a similar experience. Did you see the same screening Josh did, the 3D press screening, or did you see it just at the multiplex?
That is pretty fascinating. No, I saw it at a different theater from most of the critics, I think, at a theater closer to me. And I saw it in 2D as the third part of a triple feature of all the Star Trek films. But, you know, I did recently have that experience just a couple of days ago seeing Pete's Dragon that was in 3D. And once again, it was so dark in places that, I mean, it literally in some sequences looked like the characters had gone from day to night in just a moment's time. And it makes me wonder, why, like, 3D at this point is not a fresh new technology that we're only applying to, like, the biggest and best of blockbusters. No. Why are we still having so much trouble with light in 3D movies? Why are they not making the 3D prints brighter or at least training the projectionists in how to deal with 3D movies?
I don't know. And maybe Aaron or some other smart listener who has some technical background can shed some light on that. No pun intended.
I can't believe I did that.
I wish it was intended. I wish I knew. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, Tasha, this week's Directors We'd Bankroll Top 5 was kind of inspired by our recent poll question about the standout directors of the previous decade, the 2000s. That generated a lot of great feedback from listeners. And then I guess we just kind of got stuck in the 2000s and thought it would be a good idea to offer up a Matt Stone, Trey Parker deathmatch, South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut versus Team America, World Police, a pair of movies most listeners probably haven't thought about since 2005, except when they hear a bit of Team America in one of our Massacre Theater intro themes.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
So we weren't just stuck in the 2000s. It was really because of Sausage Party, which opens this weekend. I believe I'm correct in saying, Tasha, that neither of us have seen at this point. So we can't weigh in on that raunchy animated comedy, but we can on the Matt Stone, Trey Parker duo that we mentioned. We referred to this poll simply as the raunchy animated comedy deathmatch. That allowed connoisseurs of such films to point out that the greatest raunchy animated comedy was not one of the films from Trey Parker and Matt Stone, but of cartoonist Robert Crumb and animator Ralph Bakshi, 1972's Fritz the Cat, a movie unseen by me, so I can't weigh in. Tasha, what about you?
Personally, I've seen a lot of Bakshi just because I'm an animation buff, and he is one of those American originals who made animated movies like no one else made them. I would not actually put Fritz the Cat at the top of my list. I think Street Fight is probably raunchier and wilder, and Heavy Traffic is a more complete movie. Wizards is more fun and weird in a lot of ways. American Pop is more relevant. Fire and Ice is very Frank Frazetta and should certainly fulfill pretty much anybody's deep-seated desire for animated breasts. But, I mean, all of those films for me kind of work better than Fritz the Cat. Fritz the Cat does a really interesting job of channeling its sources. But for me, it's just this sort of weird ramble of a film that happens to have sex in it. You know, it was probably his biggest success as far as I know, but I wouldn't put it up there like in the pantheon. And I don't know how it fits with Sausage Party because, as you say, neither of us have seen it. But, oh, man, your friend who supplies you with films should probably supply you with a couple Ralph Bakshi films.
Yeah, I absolutely need to see some of his work. Now, you say all those movies are better than Fritz the Cat. If you included them in this raunchy animated comedy deathmatch, and we did not, of course, it's a deathmatch between these two Matt Parker, Trey Stone films, would you rate any of them higher as raunchy animated comedies than those two movies?
Probably Heavy Traffic.
Yeah.
Possibly none of those are as raunchy as Fritz the Cat, which is very explicitly like an X-rated film with sex in it. But I mean, all of them are sexual. All of them are, like underground comics kind of sex movies. Mm-hmm. So, they're all at least some raunchy.
Okay, well, before we belabor the giving of the results too much, we do have one bit of feedback to share here. Billy Ray Bruton, longtime listener in L.A., wrote in and said, despite both of you guys professing your prediction of a Team America pseudo landslide, I don't think you should be too surprised when South Park takes home the win. It certainly gets my vote. While I appreciated what Parker and Stone were doing with Team America, the film lacked heart. And that was something that I found in even the opening number of South Park. Sure, it's heart that's laced with profanities and bodily fluids, but it's heart nevertheless. Team America is too cynical to leave room for heart. I've watched both films recently, actually, and South Park holds up far better than Team America. Team America seems dated in 2016, while South Park still feels as fresh and irreverent as it did when it was first released. Nothing in Team America comes close to the comedic gut punch that hit me the first time I heard Blame Canada. So, well argued. We will see if listeners agreed with Billy Ray or agreed with me that Team America was obviously the better film. I did predict a landslide, and it seems, Tasha, I was wrong in my prediction.
Only slightly wrong. Yeah. Team America World Police did edge out South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, but only by a couple of points. We had South Park at 48% of the vote and Team America at 52% of the vote.
And it was neck and neck. This really did alternate right up until the poll closed. There was definitely a time where South Park was in the lead for a good chunk of the time this poll was up. Did listeners vote correctly here, Tasha? Do you have a clear preference for one over the other?
Oh, I'm with Billy Ray all the way. I think South Park has more heart. I think it's the songs are catchy. The songs are memorable.
They are.
There may be a sense that we just already had too much South Park. And it's possible that people felt that a movie was just sort of continuing a story we already had, whereas Team America was fresher. But in the end, given the choice of sitting down to either of those films, I would pick South Park.
Okay.
You know who I blame for this the skewed voting, though?
Who?
Canada.
Well played. Chris Massa in Pittsburgh, he of the Massa Minute, writes, South Park isn't a bad movie at all, but not a great one either. Team America, on the other hand, works like crazy. Not only is it smarter and funnier, but its satire has a sharper edge, and the whole thing holds up like gangbusters. So they're disagreeing with Billy Ray. The pro-USA destruction and jingoism was funny in 2004, but now it seems almost prophetic. Seriously, in a world where Donald Trump could actually become the next president of the United States, America, F yeah, sounds less like a joke and more like a chant from the floor of the RNC. There, I said it.
We've got another letter from Eddie Averill in Reseda. For the extremely rare feat of adapting a TV show into a great movie, I have to vote for Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. It is what every TV fan wants, a four-part episode of the show with stakes heightened for the cinema.
So, Eddie, just because you're from the same place as Daniel LaRusso from The Karate Kid, when he moved to Reseda, and you used the word stakes, that's not going to get me to go along with you. I'm sorry. It's just not, Eddie. But we appreciate the comment. We thank everyone who voted and left a comment in the poll. We hope you will go to filmspotting.net and participate in this new poll. As I mentioned, Josh and I are planning next week to look ahead to the fall movie season. We're going to share our most anticipated fall movies. And rather than just ask you which one you're most anticipating and try to whittle that down to four or five good candidates, we thought we would focus in on a specific subsection of movies coming out this fall. In this case, the question is, what's your most anticipated fall 2016 movie that's based on a true story? We're going to give you the options here, and we're going to give them to you in order of release.
So we have the Sundance hit Southside with You, the debut film of director Richard Tan. It's about the first date of Michelle and Barack Obama that opens in Chicago on August 26th.
Mm-hmm.
Sully is the latest from director Clint Eastwood, our professional grumpy old man in residence. That's about Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger's water landing of a commercial airline on the Hudson River and the investigation that followed. Tom Hanks stars. That opens on September 9th. Snowden is Oliver Stone's latest movie. This one's about CIA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Joseph Gordon-Levitt stars in that. It opens September 16th. Deepwater Horizon is about the 2010 oil rig explosion in the Gulf Coast, starring Mark Wahlberg, Kurt Russell, and directed by Peter Berg. Opens September 30th. The Birth of a Nation is another Sundance hit. This one's from first-time writer-director and star Nate Parker. It's about Nat Turner's 1831 effort to liberate Virginia slaves. That opens in Chicago on October 7th.
So The Birth of a Nation, definitely much buzzed about coming out of Sundance, and already perhaps an early frontrunner for Best Picture at the Oscars. All movies, as we said, based on true stories coming out this fall. Tasha, any of those movies have a shot at making your list, if you were putting one together, of the movies you're most anticipating coming out over the next 2 to 3 months, and which one of those five would you vote for?
I would probably vote for Birth of a Nation, just because at this point, pretty much everybody else on this list is kind of a known quantity for me. I'm a little curious about Southside with You, mm-hmm. but it seems like a more minor story, kind of a byway of history. Whereas the Nat Turner Rebellion, that's a part of history that I've never seen on screen before, mm-hmm. and it seems like a much more major story. Also, the buzz is so terrific. That's probably the way I'd lean.
Yeah, I would definitely go with The Birth of a Nation as well. I think that movie, for sure, will get discussed here on the show. I think that four of the five movies in this poll have a good shot at all being reviewed in detail here on the show. Deepwater Horizon, maybe the only one. I got to be honest, I've seen the trailer. I'm not that curious about it. It doesn't really hold that much interest for me. Sully is a movie, and I know I've already heard from some listeners who have said via Twitter, I was really intrigued by this movie, and now they're writing off Clint Eastwood because of his latest comments. They're holding that against him, which is fine if you consider those things when you consider the movies that you are going to go see. But Sully's one where when I heard about it, I said, there's almost no way I'm going to care about seeing this movie. And then I saw the trailer and saw the way, like a lot of Eastwood's films, it seems to be very much about the nature of what makes a hero, what defines a hero, a character wrestling with that notion. And it's not about just glorifying this character, this man, for what he did, but really wrestling with some of the fallout from what he did. I'm intrigued by Sully, I have to say. I don't know about you.
Clint Eastwood's idea of heroism, especially the lone man theory of heroism, and kind of the idea that if you're willing to make sacrifices, it doesn't matter what kind of a person you are leading up to that, has always struck me as a little morally iffy. I find his movies to be beautifully staged and relaxingly paced. I really appreciate the deliberation with which he constructs them visually and narratively. But at the same time, just an awful lot of what he personally thinks about heroism leaves me very cold.
Yeah.
So I'm a little dubious about this one.
Yeah, I can see that. And look, selfishly, the only thing I appreciated at all about the latest hubbub over his comments was that it helped fuel my theory or my take on American Sniper. I know there were some people out there that argued that it had a more nuanced take on heroism and masculinity and patriotism than a lot of us gave it credit for. Well, maybe we actually gave it just the right amount of credit. I don't know.
Maybe you personally, as a lone man reviewing films in the wilderness, were sacrificing your identity in order to present this heroic idea of what this film was like. And you were right. And the rest of the world was wrong. I look forward to Clint Eastwood's movie about you, Adam.
Someday. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. We gave you so many options there. We want to know what fall movie, which of those fall movies anyway, you're most excited to see. And if you leave a comment, we certainly hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from.
I guess you heard about the boy.
You know, word travels in this town. How long has he been out there?
6 years.
You don't survive in a forest for 6 years alone.
He says he wasn't alone.
Bryce Dallas Howard and Robert Redford in the trailer for Pete's Dragon, a remake of a movie that I adored as a kid. It's director David Lowery's live-action update of the 70s live-action movie with some animation that, again, I adored as a kid. We'll see how I feel about this one. Natasha, you have seen Pete's Dragon, but we're not going to get into it here because you're going to get into it in a lot of detail on the next batch of episodes coming in a couple weeks on the Next Picture Show. You're actually going to pair it with The Black Stallion. I have not seen that movie, so I'm going to have to do a little bit of homework before I can partake in these episodes, but I know you're excited about this pairing.
We are pretty excited about it, in part because it's going to give us a chance to revisit Carol Ballard's The Black Stallion, which is a movie that a lot of us watched when we were young and had the same kind of love for that you had for the original Pete's Dragon when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a poetic movie. It's such an elegiac movie. It's so beautifully shot. And in the same way that we were talking about, you would take your kids to see Hunt for the Wilder People, you would probably take your kids to see The Black Stallion because it creates this dreamlike fantasy that's much less about absurdity and humor in this case, but still very much about being young and being just a key part of the world, being viscerally involved in the world. I haven't revisited The Black Stallion in a long time, but I remember it as this almost Terrence Malickian version of the world, just sort of the poetry of the world around the small child who for a while is trapped on a desert island with a black stallion. The two of these movies are both about small children alone in the wilderness with a giant beast that they befriend and that nobody else properly understands, and then what it's like to transition back into civilization after having that experience. So they're both pretty intimately tied together, and they both address it in some of the same ways.
Well, if that doesn't interest you, and we certainly hope that it does, you can go to the complete opposite end of the spectrum and check out the current batch of Next Picture Show podcasts, a pairing of Suicide Squad and The Dirty Dozen. How did that taping go?
Oh, well, we decided not to wash for a month leading up to the taping, so we would all have the authentic Dirty Dozen experience. Most of us had not actually seen Robert Aldrich's The Dirty Dozen, which Suicide Squad writer-director David Ayers explicitly said that Suicide Squad was a modern riff on that movie. Watching it, it's the ties between them are very clear. I mean, both of them are about a government's attempt to round up a bunch of the worst criminals that they don't know what to do with and force them on pain of death to go serve their country. And both of those films are kind of about the fallout of that and about what heroism is and how you can achieve it even if you are, you know, despised by society. Mm-hmm. Both of them take a very, very different tack, particularly when it comes to pacing, editing, storytelling, villainy, characterization, but they're very similar in how they deal with authority, how they deal with leadership, how they deal with bonding between both heroes and non-heroes. Mm-hmm. And it wound up being a really interesting discussion, I think.
I bet. Well, again, you can check those out now over at nextpictureshow.net, or you can find the show and subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. A couple other movies we did want to quickly talk about. A movie I caught up with, you haven't seen, Tasha, a film that came out a couple weeks ago here in Chicago, Don't Think Twice, the latest from writer, director, and co-star Mike Birbiglia. It's about an improv troupe, and one of the members of the troupe, played by Keegan-Michael Key, of course, from Key and Peele, gets plucked by the Saturday Night Live stand-in called Weekend Live on the show, and we see how that affects the group dynamic and really just all of these characters kind of wrestling with who they want to be and what they want to do with their lives as improv isn't exactly paying the bills. And it's a movie I can recommend. I definitely enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the performance from both Birbiglia and Keegan-Michael Key. Gillian Jacobs from Community is really the standout of this film. She is a wonderful actress, incredibly talented, and she's really the best improv performer we see within the context of the movie as well. And Birbiglia rightfully gives her a lot of the heavy lifting here. I'm not sure that by the end of the film, Tasha, it had the impact that Birbiglia was going for. Mainly, it was a case where I felt like the movie was a little bit too aware of the emotional punch it was trying to have. And so there's a key scene, won't spoil it at all, but there's a key scene that involves an improv scene that also ends up being full of a lot of subtext and closure and characters coming to some terms with each other, that it doesn't play out organically the way I really wish that it had. It doesn't really come out of the improv the way I wish it did. It feels a little bit imposed on the performers in that scene. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but it was a case where I just felt like the movie seemed aware of what it was trying to do a little bit too much. I was trying to get an emotional response out of the audience, but otherwise a movie I can't recommend.
How loose or tight is it? When I hear about mm-hmm. a movie that features a bunch of comedians and it's about improv, I automatically think, is this going to be one of those movies where people riff and we cut together the best riffs and it might or may not be like tightly edited or tightly focused?
Mm-hmm. I have not read any interviews or seen any with Birbiglia, but my take on that from having just seen the film is that it seems pretty scripted. Obviously, there are some scenes where I'm sure they let the characters loose, but I have a feeling that even the improv scenes were, in fact, probably sketched out for the most part. I could be wrong, but it seems pretty tight to me, and that seems in keeping with Birbiglia as a filmmaker. So Jacobs, really, I think, the biggest reason to see this movie. As we're talking about performances, I'm guessing performances are another big reason why we would both recommend Hell or High Water. So I'm going to stay out of this a little bit, the new film, as we touched on at the start of this segment, starring Ben Foster and Chris Pine, because I do think Josh and I will spend a few minutes on it next week on the show when he returns. But we just came from it. Initial thoughts on that film?
One of the things that I keep saying over and over about Suicide Squad is that I wanted more villainy in it. In theory, the characters in Suicide Squad are criminals. They're the worst of the worst. They're terrible people. But the film bends over backwards to give them soft, sentimental, sticky hearts and make them likable. One of the things I liked about Hell or High Water is it focuses on these two characters played by Chris Pine and Ben Foster, and they are criminals. They start out robbing banks. You know from the beginning that they're willing to do violence in order to get what they want, and the film takes its time in telling you why. And even once it tells you why, and in theory, there are some reasons that go beyond the usual greed or selfishness or thrill-seeking that we sometimes see in movies about outlaws, but that doesn't soften them. This is a very hard movie. This movie is much like No Country for Old Men, if that movie had a less open-ended and weary ending and more of a plot-driven ending. The characters are very similar. The pursuit dynamic with Jeff Bridges as an old and tired Texas lawman mm-hmm. is very much like Tommy Lee Jones was.
He has the same kind of craggy wit that Tommy Lee Jones has in the Coen Brothers film, for sure.
He's very acerbic, and you can feel the weight of his years and his experience on him, but you can also feel the weight of a very directed responsibility. He's not a lazy lawman. He's both good at his job and feels a responsibility for what he does. It's important to him. And the dynamic of that versus these kind of good old boys, never meaning no harm. I mean, I exaggerate a bit. They're not exactly the Duke boys. They are hard men who are doing some hard things in a very hard place for some pretty hard reasons. And I found the dynamic so much more interesting than Suicide Squad as far as exploring where the line is between villainy and heroism, between criminal activity for its own sake and criminal activity for a cause and whether that justifies mm-hmm. anything. I found the character dynamics in this movie so fascinating.
You got any idea how much I owe Debbie in child support?
You got enough in your front pocket to fix that problem right now.
You can't spare it, you know that.
Maybe we should hit another branch.
You know, you talk like we ain't gonna get away with this.
I never met nobody got away with anything, ever. You.
David McKenzie, the director, also the director of Young Adam and Perfect Sense and Starred Up, all movies that I liked to greater or lesser degrees. I loved Starred Up, which is a 2014 film starring Ben Mendelsohn and Jack O'Connell, kind of one of the films that gave us Jack O'Connell as a presence. And one of the things that makes Starred Up so strong is the dynamic between those two main characters and how they test each other's masculinity and test each other's control and test each other's love for each other and for this family dynamic. Mendelsohn playing O'Connell's father in a prison where both of them have been incarcerated together. With Hell or High Water, you have the dynamic between the two brothers. And once again, you're studying the relationship between them, how they exasperate each other, how they love each other, how they're pushing each other into this criminal enterprise. And you have the relationship between Jeff Bridges, Texas lawman, and his partner, Gil Birmingham, who he teases relentlessly and sometimes in a very racist way, to which Birmingham's character just kind of rolls his eyes in weary resignation and digs back just as hard. Mm-hmm. There's so much in this film about men and machismo, how they relate to each other, the things that they can and can't say, the things that they have to do and that they can't do. And it just becomes both an outlaw story and I think a really beautifully shot, written, and executed story about relationships and causes.
Yeah, well said. I'm with you on this film, and I look forward to hearing what Josh thinks next week, but obviously a strong recommendation there from you. It does open in Chicago and in limited release around the country this weekend. We did see it together, and it was an interesting film to watch with a pretty big audience. It was a packed house. They were into the film.
Oh, yeah.
They were really into it.
It reminds me all over again why watching a film at home may be a more peaceful experience and maybe a more disturbance-free experience, but it just can't replace that sense of an audience that's really into a film. We heard gasps. There was applause. There was horror noises at a couple of developments. There were glee noises at a couple of developments. There were booming laughter moments. It's been a while since I've heard an audience that was this actively engaged mm-hmm. with a film that wasn't playing to some kind of fan dynamic, that wasn't like selling itself to an audience of young people who were primed to love these characters by TV or comics or movies. Original characters, original scenario, start from scratch, and still had the audience.
Yeah, they were just invested in the story, invested in the way it was being rendered, and invested in those characters and the performances. Up next, Tasha, we're going to pool our collective wealth, and we're going to bankroll some of our favorite directors. The top five is next. Stay with us. Wanted to get to a couple donations and some great listener comments here. First, we're going to acknowledge our featured artist this week, Sorry New Zealand. Our music is coming to us from Australia's Hockey Dad. I love that name. And their new album, Baronia, currently on U.S. tour. They are coming to Chicago's Empty Bottle on August 23rd, if you like what you heard. We have a new donor this week, David in Portland, Maine, who writes in, I've been listening pretty regularly for almost 10 years since the early Maddie ball game days, so I thought I'd chip in for a change. People more eloquent than I have extolled the virtues of film spotting, so I'll keep it short. I'm catching up on the most recent episodes, and I wanted to compliment you on reviewing Ghostbusters in such a tactful and enjoyable way. I was sort of looking forward to Suicide Squad, but I just might have to wait for the Blu-ray now. The show has simply gotten better over the years, and the ease, incisiveness, and enthusiasm the two of you bring to the podcast always keeps me listening. Please keep doing what you're doing. Respect the Pantheon, David B. I think Respect the Pantheon needs to be on a film spotting t-shirt. Thank you for the kind words, David, and the donation. And we got a gold level donation this week from Doug in Omaha, who says, hi guys, I've been listening regularly, and I must admit most lazily since episode 278, Where the Wild Things Are in 2009, always meaning to pass some money along to you. But Adam, I must say your excitement for Mask on the most recent episode woke me from my stingy slumber and made me wonder if perhaps your mother might also be named Martha. Add to that the fact that I lived in Iowa City from 1995 to 1999 while you were around those parts. Please accept this donation I've owed you guys for quite a long time. I loved hearing from listeners who also were fans in their younger days of Mask. M period, A period, S period, K period. And one listener on Twitter linked to an article that apparently they're going to make a movie out of Mask. This just came out this week along with some other properties from the 80s and 90s. So odd timing. I hadn't thought of Mask in probably 20 years until it came up on last week's show. And apparently it's coming back. Thank you to Doug again. Thank you to David as well. And all of our monthly subscribers, a no-cost way you can help the show. Rate or review us on iTunes. Our thanks to Joel DC, Mike, etc., and Will 0008, who posted quick reviews on iTunes over the past week.
Ren needs to come over and eat all the chocolate chip cookies.
I'm talking about a different one.
My friend.
With the pool and the slide.
But the pool that tried to drown me when I... Yes, I tell you a story, and then you've taken it and you've made it your own. You do this all the time.
How do you get there?
Film spotting listeners, apparently desperate for more movies that confuse the hell out of them. That was a clip from Shane Carruth's Upstream Color from 2013. Carruth was one of the more popular answers to the question I posed on Twitter recently. Which director would you bankroll for life, assuming you could? Note, they could use the support. You can't say Rian Johnson, for example. Sorry, Ryan. So what I was suggesting there, Tasha, is these are filmmakers who maybe could use the money as opposed to someone like Ryan, who I'm sure would take it and would love the artistic freedom. But a guy who just wrapped filming on the latest Star Wars installment, he's probably doing okay. He's probably going to have some options, right?
I mean, wait until we see the movie. It may be that he's completely redone Star Wars as a tragic personal indie about relationships. And I will watch the heck out of that movie.
Me too.
But, you know, if he needs a year from now, if he needs funding, he can come see us.
There you go.
We're on his side.
Yeah. Carruth, the director of two features, 2005's Primer and Upstream, both of which do make your brain hurt trying to unpack them. Both definitely worth seeing. Carruth has been busy doing scoring work for The Girlfriend Experience on Showtime, but nothing new as far as writing or directing projects are currently listed on his IMDb page. He's definitely a filmmaker I considered for this list. Top five directors we would bankroll. And maybe, Tasha, before I get into my whole spiel about what this list is, or more specifically what this list isn't, maybe you could set up what your thoughts were when I first suggested this topic to you, how you went about forming your top five.
Oh, I mean, it was just straight up glee. Yes, give me $50 billion and let me distribute it to all of the people. So many of the people that I put on my list are people that I've talked to personally, that I've interviewed and just found to be blisteringly intelligent and interesting about film. So it's not just people that I want to see make more movies. It's people that I think have so much to say, mm-hmm. and I want to hear that played out in project after project after project. Most of the people that I picked for my top list have only made one movie or a very few movies, and they're all people that I feel like if they had that genius grant level guarantee that they could make what they want and, more importantly, make what they want over time, they would produce a bunch of movies that would be very different rather than doing the same thing over and over.
Yeah. And we should point out, if it's not obvious, that this list was inspired originally by Taika Waititi, who we talked about with Hunt for the Wilder People, a filmmaker who probably could make this list for a lot of people listening right now, but is getting bankrolled. Whether or not making a Thor movie was ever what he aspired to do, he's obviously being handed a huge budget to make a film that's beyond anything he's done before. So keeping that sort of in mind, we're thinking about filmmakers, if we could hand that money to whatever they want to make. It doesn't have to be a big budget spectacle. We just want to make sure that their voices continue to be seen and heard. That's the goal here. And we got a lot of great responses, as I mentioned, on Twitter. Maybe instructive to mention a couple that I would think of for this list. We heard from Future Mr. Springer. He's at Rational Astros on Twitter. And he said, David Fincher, let him do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. So I get that impulse to go with someone like Fincher, absolutely. And I want to assert that I certainly understand that even the most established, busy directors frequently have trouble getting financing for their movies or the full financing or getting all the control they want. But I do think, Tasha, if you include a director like Fincher on this list, you're basically saying this is a list of our top five favorite directors who should forever get to make whatever they want. But if that's what we're doing, we just go ahead and call it our top five favorite directors, right? That's a different list. We're helping people who could use the help. We're being benefactors. That's how I approach this. Think Sam Wagstaff for Robert Mapplethorpe minus, you know, the living together and the sleeping together. And if you don't get that reference, I can recommend reading Patti Smith's Just Kids or watching the documentary that came out this year, a very good documentary that aired on HBO, Robert Mapplethorpe, Look at the Picture. So that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to bring work to light or make sure work continues to get made that otherwise might get overlooked a little bit. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. But also for me, like, I leaned heavily towards female directors, directors of color, mm-hmm. or directors who have made like one or two films that have been received maybe not as well as I personally would like based on my tastes. All of these directors for me are people who don't just deserve the attention, don't just have a lot to say, don't just have a lot of potential, but also who I think are really going to need the money because, you know, the industry being what it is,
yeah.
and changing the way it's changing, I think all of these people are going to need a little boost.
Okay, so I don't want to delay any further. Let's get into the list, but a couple names that came up via Twitter that didn't quite work for me. I saw a lot of people mentioned Damien Chazelle. I think that after Whiplash and with La La Land coming out, he's probably in a pretty good spot. My beloved Jeff Nichols, I think, is going to be okay for a little while. Loving is a movie that's coming out. I think it's going to get a lot of Oscar buzz. I think he's going to be safe. And I definitely considered Ryan Coogler, but he's got Black Panther coming out. So like Waititi, he's been integrated into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think he might be okay for a little while. So those are names I threw out, Tasha. And without further ado, let's get to our top five. Who's your number five director you'd bankroll?
Number five is Charlie Kaufman. You know, he recently did an interview with IndieWire in which he said he felt he had wasted his chance, that he blew it, basically. And he's only directed, I mean, he's got more of a history as a screenwriter and producer. He's got more background in film than pretty much anybody else on my list. But nonetheless, I feel like he's somebody who's really going to have a hard time coming up with more projects that he gets to direct. He's directed two films, Schenectady, New York, and Anomalisa, both very distinctive, very textured, very specific films that could not have come from the mind of anybody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about the writer of Being John Malkovich and Adaptation. We're talking about, he's got a project in the works where he's scripting Chaos Walking, which is an amazing young adult series. I don't know what he's going to do with that. That's going to be crazy in and of itself. But you look at something like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, that is not a film that anybody else could have made. I would love to see him direct more films. And after Synecdoche, I understand why he might be considered a financial risk. I don't care. That film touched me so deeply in so many ways. I was so blown away by it. And if that movie is for me and eight other people in the world, then I am happy giving this man a big pile of money to make more movies for me and eight other people in the world.
I'm with you. A great choice, Charlie Kaufman. My number five director I'd bankroll is Marielle Heller. Her movie, The Diary of a Teenage Girl, was a Golden Brick contender last year here on Film Spotting. I think it finished last of the five finalists in our Film Spotting listeners poll, but I chalked it up then and chalk it up now to the fact that at the time it was the least widely available of the five candidates. It hadn't come out on DVD yet. It wasn't still in theaters. I just think too many people missed it, unfortunately, and I hope plenty of people get a chance to see more work from Heller. This film, Diary, starred a newcomer, Belle Powley. She's So Good, who is the daughter of Kristen Wiig. She's dating Alexander Skarsgård, and the daughter develops a sexual relationship with the boyfriend. And I was reading a little bit about the background and how she came to this project, and she said it was an eight-year process where her younger sister gave her the graphic novel that it's based on in 2002, and she became so obsessed with it that she stopped reading it, called the publisher, and just said, I'm going to do something with this. And eventually it did come to fruition. I like her sensibility. I like this movie a lot, as I mentioned. But in an IndieWire article, she mentioned five films that influenced Diary of a Teenage Girl. One of them was Lovely and Amazing from Nicole Holofcener, a movie I'm not a huge fan of, but definitely have a lot of respect for. The other four, though, Tasha, were Eternal Sunshine, The Breakfast Club, Harold and Maude, and Hedwig and the Angry Inch. So any filmmaker who is using those four movies as any kind of influence, I'm going to be a fan of. And I'm also going to be a fan of any filmmaker like Kaufman who is taking the types of chances that Heller is taking as she's looking to future projects. She said in an interview that she is working on a personal script with an idea that's similar to the, quote, not totally realistic world of Diary, with animation, exploring different mediums and ways of storytelling. I'm interested in character-driven women's stories, and all stories, telling them in ambitious and crazy ways that other people might think are insane. So,
sold.
Yeah, sold on, first of all, character-driven women's stories, but then stories that are told in ambitious and crazy ways. She has a lot coming out if you look at IMDb, which I guess both justifies her inclusion on this list and actually makes the case against it. Maybe she doesn't need any help because there seems to be a lot of interest in what she's working on. But since I was only going off of Diary of a Teenage Girl, it's good to see that she's got these projects that also sound so intriguing. The Case Against Eight, which is a drama that's been announced based on the true story of the court case to lift the ban on same-sex marriage in California. Colma, which is a drama slash fantasy slash thriller that's been announced starring Daisy Ridley about a remarried widow who gets an unusual offer to relive her first love as the end of her life draws closer. So that sounds interesting. And Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is a drama that's in pre-production right now. Holofcener wrote the script and Melissa McCarthy stars. So all three of those projects sound interesting to me. And I just want to make sure that Heller keeps getting opportunities to make movies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, those are terrific touchstones that she cites. But second of all, just because something is announced on the IMDb as a project doesn't mean we're ever going to see it.
You're right.
So maybe throwing money in that direction will make sure that these things happen. My number four is Jennifer Kent, the writer-director of The Babadook, which is a horror movie that came out of nowhere, as so many horror movies seem to do. So many young directors getting their start seem to go into horror because it's an easy sell. Like, people assume that there's going to be a built-in audience. You can get a little money for it. Increasingly, you can do some really cool horror stuff with very low budgets. And that's exactly what she did here. But The Babadook is one of those movies that comes along that you think this director is already fully developed. She knows what she wants. She knows how to achieve it. She knows what she's doing. She knows what kind of effect she can have on people, but she also has, she went into this story with an idea that was bigger than people get scared of a monster. There's so much going on intellectually and thematically in The Babadook, and it's got so much to do with women and the unspoken. You know, it's horror as the thing that you don't dare express,
yeah.
The thing that you don't dare acknowledge and don't dare share with anyone. And there's some really touchy, dangerous, edgy subjects going on under the surface of what is also very clearly just a pretty scary horror movie.
Hi. I want to report someone stalking me and my child.
Can you tell us what happened?
Somebody sent me a children's book.
And?
And it contained violent and graphic images of my child and me being murdered.
Can we have a look at the book, please?
I burnt it.
You burnt it?
Yes.
Well, unfortunately, there's nothing we can do about it.
He's been making phone calls to me as well.
What's he been saying?
Nothing, just making these noises.
How do you know it's the same person?
Because of what he wrote in the book.
The book you burnt?
Yes.
I was so impressed with The Babadook, and as she does have a film listed as a pre-production on IMDb coming out next year sometime, so that's something. But I would like to make sure that she has the freedom to continue to explore all of these things that she's talked about in interviews in terms of what makes horror. And I'd like to see what she does if she's not kind of playing to the built-in horror audience and she has more freedom to explore like other ways of telling the stories she wants, mm-hmm. assuming that's what she wants.
Yeah, well documented here on the show that horror isn't my go-to genre, but I'm a big fan of The Babadook and big fan of Jennifer Kent. Great pick. I didn't know if we would have any overlap on this list. And in fact, we talked before coming into tape and we just thought it would probably work out that we'd have five unique picks, but we've got some overlap right off the bat here, Tasha, because my number four is Charlie Kaufman. Synecdoche was my number nine film of 2008. Anomalisa was my number nine film of last year, 2015. And as you mentioned, as a writer, very well known for Malkovich and Eternal Sunshine and Adaptation, Synecdoche made only $4.4 million at the box office. Anomalisa, from what I read, recouped less than $6 million of the $8 million it cost to make. So that math isn't going to help any filmmaker and definitely not help Charlie Kaufman. You talked about that interview that came out on IndieWire, the article that David Ehrlich did. Great conversation he had with him and a great article. And all you need to know is the title of the article, the headline, which is Charlie Kaufman reflects on his career. I feel like I effing blew it. We'll link to that in our show notes at filmspotting.net. But in that article, Ehrlich writes, in the wake of Anomalisa, Kaufman's choices are growing limited. He's recently been forced to confront the idea that he may no longer be able to direct his own screenplays. I feel like the stuff that I write is personal, and I would like to be in charge of it, he said, before sincerely reiterating how much he loved working with Spike Jonze and Michel Gondry, who shepherded Kaufman's scripts to the screen before the writer finally achieved the juice necessary to step behind the camera. There aren't people chomping at the bit to hire me as a director, and I've really held out with things for years now because that's what I want.
I'm
with you. He's just such a vital, risk-taking voice. His films are always really cerebral and challenging, but also somehow they're always so intimate, at times painfully so. Last year at our rap party, Josh picked as his favorite musical moment of the year the Girls Just Want to Have Fun sequence from Anomalisa, and what I termed puppet sex, that scene was one of my scene of the year candidates, really, because it made me so uncomfortable in a good way by showing the messiness and the awkwardness and the reality of sex, and he pulled it off somehow with puppets.
With puppets.
But Chaos Walking, you mentioned, and going back to what Ehrlich wrote there, not getting opportunities to direct his own scripts. That's the case with this that's coming out. Doug Liman's directing this movie, and the premise for it does sound fascinating, and it sounds right up Kaufman's alley, a dystopian world where there are no women and all living creatures can hear each other's thoughts in a stream of images, words, and sounds called noise. Like, I'm in. I'm in with Liman directing it. I like a lot of his work. I'd be even more in if Kaufman was directing his own screenplay, though.
I would be so surprised, though, if Charlie Kaufman had our bottomless well of funding, if that would be a project that interested him. Because it's not personal. It's not something that he generated. It comes from a really good series of books, and it's a really good source, but it's not from him. And so much of his work is so intimate and so as you say, so painful, so much dealing with his personal issues. Maybe it sounds weird to say, I just want him to continue to do therapy in film form for us,
yeah.
Apparently the two of us and seven other people. But I don't see – there are other people in the world that could script the adaptation of that YA series. I don't think there's anybody else in the world that would give us an Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind or, better yet, a Synecdoche.
Yeah. I was always so dismayed when I saw some responses to Anomalisa and Kaufman, people who aren't fans of his work on Twitter, and they would dismiss him with things basically sort of more talking about his personality and how toxic he seems to be and how he is kind of a person who comes off as a bit of a misanthrope. And I'm thinking, yeah, exactly. And he's working through all of that in these films. That's what makes them so fascinating. It's not as if he's saying, this is the way we should all live. This is a paragon of how human beings should be. I feel like that's what makes him so special. So
I try not to sigh heavily into the mics because I don't know how that's gonna play. But that's just so missing the mark in terms of what makes him fascinating. The way that he grapples with his misanthropy is through his art, and the way his characters grapple with their problems in life is through art, and they create things like nobody else, like the giant bizarre puppets in John Malkovich, or like the endless sprawling play in Synecdoche. The meta quality that he brings to dealing with his issues by having his characters deal with his issues, it's nobody else's worldview.
Yeah, we are on the same page there. Let's see if we have any more overlap as we get into our top three. Who's your number three?
Number three is Justin Simien, the writer-director of Dear White People. And that is a film that I found flawed in a couple of ways, but I think that the flaws come from the fact that Simien is trying to do so many things at once. I interviewed him back in the Dissolve days, and he comes across as such a blisteringly intelligent person who is so steeped in the history of film and the imagery of film, how films are constructed and made, how stories are told. And he is so full of stories that he wants to tell. I found Dear White People flawed in that it strikes me as a little cold. And that is in part because he's drawing on filmmakers like Stanley Kubrick, who he deeply admires. But I feel like there is so much potential there for what he wants to do, both in terms of telling stories that we don't often see on the screen. In this case, it's the story of a bunch of Black college students who are all overachievers, who are all highly intellectualized, and who are all groping around the idea of their racial identity and their human identity and their relationships to each other.
Well, on behalf of all the colored folks in the room, let me apologize to all the better qualified white students whose place we're taking up.
No, it's fine. We're okay.
I'm sorry, did you get lost? Bichet's that way.
Oh, I know where it is. I'm actually supposed to eat there. Yeah, it's just this is the only dining hall that you can actually get yourself some chicken and waffles. Look, you're Dear White People, right? It's funny. It's funny stuff. It really is. How have we not staffed you yet?
Oh, me? Oh, what? On Pastiche, your uninspired humor magazine?
It's actually much more than just a magazine, sweetheart. SNL staff is basically half Lampoon, half Pastiche. Same goes for the network comedies.
And what gives you Clubhouse kids the right to come to our dining hall? You don't live here.
Sam, what are you doing?
So you can't eat here.
Chill, Sam. Damn, all right? Let the man...
I got this.
Look, who are you to throw me out?
Oh, well, I think I'm head of this house. And I'm doing things my way.
I feel like this is a kind of story that we gloss over so often in the obsession that we have with stories of the streets. We don't get the stories of Black people in Ivy League colleges. And this is something that he wanted to explore for a variety of reasons, which he's been very outspoken about and very interesting about, just wanting to bring stories to the screen that aren't being told. And I found him just to be such a fascinating person, both in his thoughts on the history of film and how film works, but also in the way that he constructed this story. It's such a strange and interesting and unusual film in the way he uses music and slow motion and titles and kind of Spike Lee look at the camera tricks to convey who these people are and the definitional problems they're having in trying to figure out who they are.
Yeah.
I really want to see more from him, and I really want him, again, this is probably just going to be a drum I'm going to beat throughout the segment, I want him to have the opportunity to make enough projects that we can see the range of different things that he wants to do around all of the ideas he has.
Josh recommended Dear White People pretty strongly last year on the show, and somehow, Tasha, I failed to get to it. So Simeon, a director I certainly knew would come up, saw his name on Twitter, obviously couldn't make my list because I still haven't seen the movie. I'm really glad he made yours. My number three is Kelly Reichert, the director of Old Joy and Wendy and Lucy, of course, Meek's Cutoff, Night Moves, her recent movie, a foray a little bit into a pure genre movie, or at least a genre movie the way Kelly Reichert would make it, a bit of a thriller there. And she's got Certain Women coming out in October with Michelle Williams, who she has used a few times, Laura Dern and Kristen Stewart. Great cast there. I mean, three just really formidable actresses kind of at the height of their powers right now, I'd say. And it's a story, from what I know about it, vaguely, it's just about three different women living in different small towns, and at some point their lives do intersect. Your former colleague, Tasha, from The Dissolve and from the AV Club, Noel Murray, wrote about Certain Women at Sundance and said this: "For those willing to trust that Reichert is in full command of this material, Certain Women is utterly enthralling. The glacial storytelling has a mesmerizing effect and also gives audiences time to drink in the big skies against which the humans look so insignificant, and to appreciate the careful way that Reichert establishes what the heroines are up against. The cold, the distance, the arduous labor, the subtle class divisions, and the unwelcoming men, all of these help define why these Certain Women are the way they are." And Reichert is one of these filmmakers who makes these really complex interpersonal dramas. They are usually very intimate, but she can paint on a broader canvas. I think we got that in Meek's Cutoffs. And she's obviously focusing a lot on women's stories, which I think is really important, but not exclusively that. And she is a woman who is truly expressing her voice as a filmmaker, in that not only is she writing and directing these films, but she is now editing a lot of her films. And her budgets have gradually increased. She's getting more stars interested in her films. She's getting bigger projects coming her way, or she's getting to make the projects she wants. But in an interview I found, Tasha, she said of Certain Women, "It's still a super low budget. I'd love to have more time and money to shoot with. I'm getting too old to do these small budget movies, but it's improving." So it's improving, but you hear that resignation in that quote. And I want to keep her as motivated and as energized as possible. And hopefully she's got many more films left in her.
She needs that Adam money.
There you go.
You know, Old Joy left me a little cold, and Wendy and Lucy frustrated me quite a bit. But Meek's Cutoff for me was the film where Reichert kind of came into herself as just a really confident storyteller, somebody who had something very distinctive and different to say and was just doing it so perfectly. I still haven't caught up with Night Moves. It's high on my list. I regret having not gotten there. And clearly I'm going to have to catch up with it before I see Certain Women.
Yeah.
But I think she's a really good pick. I think that pretty much anybody who has this strong an identity as a filmmaker, who has this strong a voice, and who has this strong an idea of the stories she wants to tell, should not have to run up against the wall of, but she's a woman and she's telling women's stories over and over and over again. And that resignation that you cite there really worries me, Adam. Mm-hmm. I really don't want her to leave the field.
No. Your number two.
My number two is, speaking of women, Gina Price Bythewood. She's the director of Love and Basketball. She made the adaptation The Secret Life of Bees. And most recently in 2014, she made this romance movie called Beyond the Lights, which was just so striking for me. It's sort of a romantic comedy without the comedy. What do you call those movies?
The anti-romantic comedy? I don't know.
I think you call it a romance, but we barely have a place in the American marketplace anymore for just straight romances that aren't Nicholas Sparks movies, that aren't dripping with sentiment and golden Thomas Kincaid light, and that are actually about how people relate to each other. There was something just really striking about Beyond the Lights. It's the story of a very successful young pop star played by Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who falls for one of her bodyguards after she attempts suicide because she's so distraught over the way she's being controlled and remade by an industry that only cares how they can sexualize and sell her. And the movie ends up being very sensual, just rawly sensual in a way that is really kind of rare for romantic movies these days. But it also it's smart and dedicated and intelligent and giving about what it means to make art in the world today, about what it means to make a connection with someone, and particularly about power dynamics. You know, the power dynamics are so imbalanced between these two people, and they have to figure out how to navigate that. And at the same time, it's just a really sweet romantic story. She and Mombatha Raw were more people that I interviewed back at the Dissolve, and I was just so struck with both of them in terms of the way they define the kinds of stories that they want to tell and how they recognize the stories that aren't being told in the field. And I kind of feel like this entire top five list for both of us is a little bit about we're seeing the same stories over and over. We want something different, and
yes,
we know who can provide it for us because they've done it all right. They've done it once before. We want them to do it again and again.
Yeah, very well said. And I'm glad we did this list just because you put this filmmaker on my radar. I remember Beyond the Lights coming out and getting some attention, but I wasn't able to make time for it. And I haven't seen the other two films either. So you've shamed me, but in a good way here, Tasha. I really need to seek out her work. My number two, I'm going to mention this quote here, read this quote really quickly from Werner Herzog, talking about this filmmaker's debut film. I have not seen a film as powerful, surreal, and frightening in at least a decade, unprecedented in the history of cinema. And a lot of us had a similar response to that. The movie The Act of Killing, our 2013 Golden Brick winner, the director Joshua Oppenheimer. He followed that up with The Look of Silence, where he returned to Indonesia, returned to a similar subject matter in terms of confronting a lot of murderers and confronting their crimes that they still haven't been punished for, but takes a different approach. It's not about blurring narrative and nonfiction styles and fantasy and reality. And instead of it being him behind the camera, he's still behind the camera, but this time it's not him asking questions. It's another person. It's a victim, someone who had his brother killed and other family members who's doing the confronting. Nothing about what I just described, if you haven't seen either of these films, suggests anybody is ever going to be looking to hand Joshua Oppenheimer a truckload of money or that commercial success is remotely a concern of his. He is clearly taking chances artistically, obviously, but of course, more importantly, he's taking chances politically. He received death threats for both films. He can't go back to Indonesia at this point. He's doing capital I important work as a filmmaker, telling stories that a lot of people would be simply too scared to tell, and he's doing it in a unique way. The Act of Killing took 5 years to finance, from what I read, and the relative success of Act and The Look of Silence has put him in a position where he's struggling less. He gets to be a little more choosy about who finances his movies and how, but obviously we're still a long way from whatever he wants to do being a slam dunk, and he's going to follow up these two documentaries with another documentary he's working on, but he's also developing two narrative features, including a musical.
What?
Joshua Oppenheimer is going to make a musical, and it gets even better, Tasha, if this is still true anyway from the article I found. It's inspired by Samuel Beckett's play Happy Days. So a musical inspired by Samuel Beckett, and he's going to write and direct both narrative projects, and they're going to follow his third documentary. Apparently, he's a big fan of musicals, and this article says he intends to push the boundaries and conventions of the genre as he has done with his documentary. So I want to see that musical. I want to see that Western. I want to see whatever genre Joshua Oppenheimer wants to work in. I want to see that movie.
I thought I was taping Film Spotting. I seem to have wandered onto the set of Punk'd.
Yeah?
I'm sorry, a musical from Joshua Oppenheimer.
Right.
Based on Samuel Beckett.
I know.
I find that
I'm not
so
clever enough to make that up, Tasha. So,
man, well, okay. Well, this is a fantastic pick, Joshua Oppenheimer. I am a person who does not inherently believe that most films are obligatory. I don't like the phrase like must see. I don't like the idea that you know people when you there are movies that you say I haven't seen that and they say you have to see that. You have to see that to be a critic. You have to see that to be an American. You have to see that to be complete, whatever. No, there's so many films out there. There's nothing that you have to see. except possibly the act of killing. Because the act of killing is possibly the most intelligent and revealing film I have ever seen about why people do incredibly evil things and then how they justify them.
Yeah, how they rationalize it.
The banality of evil, I feel like, has rarely been better explored. And he does it in such a creative and interesting way. I back you 100%. I want Joshua Oppenheimer to get all of the support and love and attention and money he needs. But a musical? I guess I want to see that happen just to see what that looks like. I mean, he is an important filmmaker, but apparently he's a crazy ambitious one too.
Right. Yeah. Number one. Your number one director you'd bankroll.
This is a really left field choice, but it's what I feel in my heart. Are you familiar with the filmmaking team known as the Daniels?
I am. Swiss Army Man. Yeah.
Daniel Scheinert and Daniel Kwan, they count as one filmmaker because they only make films together. And they did, in fact, just make their first feature, Swiss Army Man. And it is a weird, weird movie about Paul Dano lost in the wilderness, accompanied only by the farting corpse of Daniel Radcliffe. It's a very, very strange movie. But here's the thing. I first encountered Daniels at the Tribeca Film Festival several years ago while they were working on a series of very ambitious projects involving interactivity. And they were exploring how technology lets you tell filmmaking stories in different ways. They were studying different ways of manifesting narrative in ways that people could change the story while still experiencing something like linear and progressive that would actually tell a story, as opposed to give them like little snippets of things that made no sense. And I wound up sitting down and talking to them for about 2 hours.
No kidding.
In a series of locations that one would close and would move to the next. It's one of my favorite all-time interviews that I did at The Dissolve. I love these guys. And when they came to town for Swiss Army Man, I walked through the door and they both hugged me immediately. So I have to admit a certain personal bias, but I also, just talking to them about Swiss Army Man, it is so easy to dismiss this movie as a bunch of fart jokes. But what it is this very strange exploration of mortality and the way that our physical bodies haunt us, the obligations that they render on us, the way they pin us down and hold us down, the horror of death, the curiosity about what comes after. It's about loneliness in this strange, like Michel Gondry, almost Wes Anderson sort of way. And yet it is so distinctly a film that only they could have made. I feel like it's a distinctly a film that only they would have dared to have made. And once again, these people are so full of ideas, so full of creativity and lust for life and lust for art. I really want to see what they come up with next. And I'm terrified that they won't get the opportunity because Farting Daniel Radcliffe corpse movie.
Radcliffe is very good in that role. So is Paul Dano. And listeners who heard the review here on the show, episode 593, they know I was mixed on Swiss Army Man, but I certainly understand everything you're saying, and you have more than convinced me that I should be very excited about whatever comes next from the Daniels. My number one is maybe a little bit of an odd choice. Certainly at age 56, the oldest director on my list, and someone I think a lot of people would hear and think, well, he seems pretty established, but also I think most people listening will still think of this filmmaker as a bit of an obscure name. But as we're talking about pushing boundaries and conventions, for me it comes down to Jafar Panahi from Iran, the filmmaker who gave us This Is Not a Film, Taxi to Iran, one of my top 10 films of last year, The Mirror, one of my top 50 or so films of all time, and the more conventional but very good Offside from 2006, which was part of our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon. If you don't know about all of his dealings with the government and how he's been imprisoned and prohibited from doing his work, you can find the full list of all of that certainly by doing a Google search. But I'll note that in December 2010, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison and he was banned for 20 years from making or directing any movies or writing screenplays or even giving any form of interview. He was later placed on house arrest, and the movie This Is Not a Film that came out in 2011 documents that struggle, a filmmaker still trying to be a filmmaker while stuck in his living room, while being confined to his home. It was shot on a digital camcorder, partly on an iPhone, and
smuggled out of the country in a cake, wasn't
absolutely
it?
Yeah. And we see him sitting in his apartment and making phone calls and talking to his lawyer about his court case, and he's watching news stories, and he talks to neighbors, and he also recreates scenes from his past movies and stages scenes from the screenplay that he wants to film. So he's a guy who is, I think, fair to say, a very humanist filmmaker. His films tend to focus on the best of who we are, and he's a formalist, but he isn't by any means beholden to any dogma. I get the sense with Panahi that if you gave him a stick of gum and a matchbook and a magnifying glass, he'd find some way to make a movie out of that. You just can't contain his creative impulse. And I guess, Tasha, for me, the reason he's at number one is if I had all this wealth that we're talking about here, I would probably use it to mount the case that would literally free him so we can then give him the financial freedom he needs so he has more tools at his disposal. I think we need Panahi and we need his sensibility more than ever right now. And I hope he has opportunities to make more films.
What a fascinating choice. He would not have occurred to me just because giving him money wouldn't help. I mean, you'd have to either get him out of country or bribe the entire government to drop the charges and let him make films again. I mean, I suppose that you could argue that the constraints he's under, there's certainly filmmakers that say that, and one of them is Lars von Trier, that the limitations that you operate under make your art stronger and more powerful. But I would kind of prefer, rather than watching him struggle to make a film when he's not allowed to make films, I would rather have him making more films like Offside, which is just such a jubilant and creative and wonderful and beautifully executed film. I'm a little torn just because he's found so many interesting ways around the obligations that have been put on him.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. He's certainly a distinctive voice that we want out there in the world.
Yeah. So stretching what I'm doing with the money here a little bit as a benefactor to Panahi. But you know what? It's our rules and we get to make them up as we go along here, Tasha. So those are our top five directors we'd bankroll. Are there any honorable mentions you want to throw out?
Oh, so many honorable mentions. A few of them you touched on. Damien Chazelle, Drew Goddard, Ava DuVernay, Jeremy Saulnier. I think all of them fall into those categories of people who are going to be all right without our money, people who are in a pretty good place right now, and like all of whom I love what they do and I want to see more of them, but I think they're going to have those opportunities. People who maybe could use the help and are just off the bottom of the top five would be Lynn Ramsey, Robert Eggers, who just had his debut film, The Witch, and I'm dying to see what he does next. Laszlo Nemes, who just had his first film, Son of Saul. Sebastian Shipper just had his first film, Victoria. Lou Howe, his first film, Gabriel. Ben Dickinson did First Winner and Creative Control. And Sanjay Patel, the director of Pixar's short Sanjay's Super Team. I don't even know if he counts. He hasn't even made his first feature yet. But he's such an intelligent and inquisitive person. He did such an amazing job with that first short. He brought something to Pixar that Pixar hadn't done before. And I would really love to see him given the opportunity to make more films on his own terms.
Yeah. One of the names I certainly considered at first, I thought this is too big of a name, but I think it really does fit our criteria. Spike Lee.
Oh, sure.
You know, Spike Lee proved, as Josh talked a lot about last year with Chirac, that he's still a very vital filmmaker and someone who can be provocative in all the right ways, not only politically, but aesthetically. And he's a guy who clearly is not getting the green light anymore. He's not just being handed big studio projects. I mean, he's fighting to get these movies made at this point. So definitely someone to consider. I think Sarah Pauly is probably okay. Maybe it's just that the Canadian Film Board just seems to be generous enough and they seem to like her and she seems to get her movies made. But I'm a big fan of her work.
God bless the Canadian Film Board in general for what they've accomplished.
Yep. Lynn Shelton, Andrea Arnold, and Cleo Barnard also names. I wanted to mention Barnard gave us The Arbor, a previous Film Spot and Golden Brick winner as well. Saulnier got mentioned, Jeremy Saulnier for Green Room and his debut film Blue Ruin. Andrew Hay gave us The Great Weekend and 45 Years last year. John Carney of my beloved Sing Street and Once.
I would have put him on the list, but I really thought that he was in that doing okay kind of place.
He might be.
I thought he was maybe a little too professionally advanced. Same thing with Lynn Ramsey and Deborah Granik, both of whom I'd love to see more of.
Yorgos Lanthimos, another name that a lot of people mention on Twitter, but I think we both agree he's probably doing okay and doesn't need our help at this point. A few other names that maybe could. Peter Strickland, who made Barbarian Sound Studio and I think the better film, The Duke of Burgundy. Mm-hmm. Joel Patrykis, who gave us Buzzard. Trey Edward Schultz, who gave us Krisha, my number three favorite film of this year, I think, so far. And Sean Baker, the filmmaker who made Tangerine, a film spotting favorite here last year. So there really are so many names that we did mention, many more that we could probably mention, and we hope that you will share the names you want to mention with us. You can send those pics or any other comments about the show to us at feedback@filmspotting.net. Out in limited release this weekend, Hell or High Water, the new one from startup director David McKenzie, highly recommended by both myself and Tasha. Kylie Blues, I hope I'm saying that right. We heard from Sean Gilman, who's been a guest on this show before. He describes the movie as being part of a new wave of independent Chinese directors making narratively adventurous films in locations we've never seen. It's about the past and the present and the future, guilt and family and history and magic tied together with a remarkable 40-minute long take that's not only technically cool but fundamental to the film's haunting, mysterious sense of community. It's one of the best films of the year, Sean says. He definitely has me convinced. Phantom Boy, also out from the directors of the Oscar-nominated animated feature A Cat in Paris, about an 11-year-old who discovers he has the power to leave his body and fly through walls.
I've seen that. It's a fun, strange little animated French movie.
Hmm. Out in wide release, Florence Foster Jenkins. This stars Meryl Streep as an heiress who dreams of being an opera singer despite having a terrible voice. I can relate. Directed by Stephen Frears. Also, Pete's Dragon and Sausage Party. We will probably not get to any Pete's Dragon or Sausage Party talk next week, but you never know. What I do know is Josh will be back, and we are planning our fall movie preview and another installment in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon. I mentioned our email account, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Filmspotting. Tasha Robinson, where can people find you on Twitter? Where can they find your work?
You can find me writing about film at TheVerge.com. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson, no space.
And, of course, the Next Picture Show podcast. Subscribe if you haven't already done so. You can find it in iTunes. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. Special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information at WBEZ.org. Our music this week is from the Aussie band Hockey Dad from the new album Baronia. More information at hockeydad.bandcamp.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
We've been doing a little warm-up that we then sort of include at the end of the show where we just kind of talk about what we did this weekend and what we saw, if it's worth sharing at all. I know you were on a little road trip.
I was on a little road trip, so I saw exactly no movies.
But you did have fun.
Oh, I had a blast. I mean, I'll talk about it all day long, but...
Where'd you go?
It will not be about movies at all. I went to Indianapolis for Gen Con, which is a gaming convention advertised as the best 4 days in gaming, which I believe it in fact is.
Yeah?
Yeah. I am...
And it's in Indiana?
It's in Indiana. There is a tremendous convention center surrounded by hotels there. And Gen Con has grown by 8,000 to 10,000 people every year for the past 6 or 7 years. So at this point, it's basically a spontaneous community of about 75,000 people that forms over this one weekend sometime in August.
I had never heard of it.
Well, perhaps you are not a role-playing or board gaming dork.
No. That I don't think I qualify.
I mean, it's very specific. It's like one of the things I'm finding out working for The Verge is that there are a lot of tremendously specific technological trade shows that I've never heard of that for some people are just like the biggest event of the year. And this is – Gen Con is kind of like that. Like it's a really big deal if you happen to, I don't know the release schedule for board games for the year. And yeah, if for everybody else, maybe not so much.
So my two oldest kids just started playing Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, gosh.
And they're pretty hooked.
Are they –
They love it.
This may be too granular. Are they starting with fifth edition? Are they playing the newest one that's out?
Asking the wrong guy. I don't know. It's a family friend who is really into it. And a couple Sundays, I've let the kids go over and they've just spent the day playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Come on, Adam. I want details. Are they playing tiefling rogues? Are they playing half-orc fighters?
What language are you speaking now?
What level are they right now? Like, which modules have they done? Come on.
I will get all the answers to these questions by the time we tape together again. How's that?
So you've got about 6 months to...
Maybe so.
But by that time, it'll all have changed.
Okay. I'll ask them. I'll email you. I promise. We just got back from Puerto Rico and... One movie I watched on the way back, I didn't have any plans, but it's about a five-hour flight. And so I bring up iTunes to see what I've got in terms of movies. And a listener, a longtime listener, Jim Pellini in Bethpage, New York, occasionally when he hears me mention during a top five a movie that's a regret that I haven't seen, a few days after that show airs, I'll get an email with an iTunes gift.
Aww.
And he will send me that and say, you know, you need to watch this movie, so here you go. And he gifts it to me. And in the case of Moonstruck, it was a regret from our list of the top five films of 1987, and I hadn't seen it, so I couldn't include it. And he sent me a note and said, life is too short for regrets, and that's one of the themes of the movie, so I'm sending you Moonstruck. So there it was, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm gonna watch Moonstruck. Have you seen it?
Yeah, back in the day.
I was shocked at how much I loved it.
Oh, really?
Loved it. Love all the performances. Give Cher all the Oscars. She deserved it. Olympia Dukakis deserved it. Every cast member there deserves an Oscar. And Jewison, as a filmmaker, too, I was shocked at just... I was surprised at just how attentive he was to the details of the characters' faces and their reactions. The whole movie, all the performances are built on their reactions to things. It's not just... the dialogue. You know, even that famous moment, the snap out of it moment, is this great bit of physical activity. And it's the look on Cher's face when Nicolas Cage says that back to her, that he might be in, that he's in love with her. It's just such a rich movie. The screenplay, John Patrick Shanley, I think it should be one of those screenplays. If it's not taught in film school, it should be. It's perfect. Hmm. There's just nothing wrong structurally with the movie Moonstruck, and the way he weaves all of it together, introduces so many characters and little subplots, but they all just mingle together perfectly. I loved it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you have a friend who can send you a coupon for 2 extra hours to make your day a little longer?
Exactly.
So you can fit these movies in.
I know. That's the problem.
No one
can figure that out.
All of my regrets are I don't have time to
don't
watch
have time.
This. I mean,
yeah.
they pile up infinitely.
Yeah. And my problem is that when I get on a plane like that, I think, I've got 5 hours. So I'm stuck here where this will compel me to use this time to catch up on a movie like Moonstruck. This is my chance. The unfortunate part is now most planes I fly on have Wi-Fi. So what do? I just get on and I just do things.
Mm-hmm.
I go through film spotting emails. I work on the show. I do all the things that I need to get done rather than just relax and watch a movie. And so on the flight back, that's what I did on the way out there for the most part. I did get something cool in, but I'll talk about it when Josh comes back, where I read the first volume of the new Vision comic book.
Oh, yeah?
So good.
Hmm.
So good.
Do you know who's writing it?
Yeah, Tom King.
Oh, gotcha.
It's really good. But other than that, I pretty much just did work the whole time. So I said on the way back, I'm going to watch something, and it worked out. Hmm. Moonstruck was great.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to getting back into the swing of watching things rather than role-playing things.
Mm.
But, I mean, that said, if Gen Con was 2 weeks long, I would be there for 2 weeks. I would have no problem with that.
No kidding. Film Spotting is listener-supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.